The How Not to Suck a Divorce podcast cannot be copied or rebroadcast without consent. This podcast does not contain legal advice. The information contained herein and provided on the podcast and the resources available are not intended and shall not be construed as legal advice. And with that, enjoy the show.
Hey there, it's Andrea. Listen, chances are if you're listening to our show, then things might not be going so amazing in your life right now. And I get it. I have been there. Morgan and I want to offer you as much support and as much guidance as we possibly can. So go check out the How Not to Suck at Divorce community. And more importantly, go check out the DCC. That stands for Divorce Crash Course. Direct link to both of those in our show notes. This is the only divorce podcast that's one part family law attorney and one part recovering comedian. We're dedicated to bringing you action steps, empathy, and a healthy side of snark. This is How Not to Suck at Divorce.
Whether you're navigating a high conflict divorce
or just trying to feel like you're not sucking at a sucky process, our Family Wizard is our pro tip that you must check out.
It's a co-parenting app that, if used correctly, will help you stop texting your ex.
No more passive-aggressive messages blowing up your phone while you're trying to work.
Tip from a divorce attorney, go sign up for their newsletter.
You'll get access to a special article written just for our listeners. Go to ourfamilywizard.com/notsuck. That's ourfamilywizard.com/notsuck.
Do I sound excited today?
Is that a trick question?
Probably, because last time I listened to our last episode, I think I sounded like I had no personality and I was like just getting through the episode. But do I sound better today?
I don't know. Oh my gosh. I mean, you sound amazing.
Last episode, I didn't even like myself. If I was listening to me, I wouldn't have liked myself.
Oh God. Well, there's a hard pitch.
I know, but Jesus. I like myself now and I'm going to tell you why. So Remember when I was out of town, I went out of the country for spring break for a little bit, came back with quite the stomach bug, picked up God knows what from where. And, you know, I was just toughing it out because I was like, I'm not going to the doctor. This'll pass. I'm not getting antibiotics.
Literally.
Yeah, exactly. It will pass, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I stuck it out for about a good 10 days. It was a complete misery. At day 10, I went in, got some antibiotics. Guess what? I'm on day 2 of antibiotics. I feel phenomenal. I don't even know why I waited so long. It's
Wait,
like 2 days.
Why are you on? I don't understand. What? You went in with a stomach bug and they gave you antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what it was. It could be some kind of bacteria, whatever I picked up. I think it's honestly something I ate in another country. So without getting into the gory details, I want to tell you, I'm relating it back to us adulting because nobody has time to go to the doctor, right? Like you don't have time for that. But the fact is I went 2 days in, I feel so much better. I feel like I have my energy back. I'm a human again. And now I can record this podcast and maybe people will like me again.
You know what? I really like how you brought it back to this. I get it now. You are not human. You were, I do recall last week, now that you're giving me more, you were dehydrated. You had said to me, you know, off the air, you're like, oh, girl, I've been through it. I am not feeling great. So I get that. I remember, you know, like a year ago when I had my hysterectomy and I got real sick afterwards, we were recording. And when I listened back to those episodes, I'm like, man, woof, I was a shell of a person. So welcome back to the world of the living.
I feel good about this. Today was a really positive day. You know, you don't even know how miserable you are until you're not miserable anymore. And that's kind of like our listeners at times, right?
Ooh, yeah.
You're doggy paddling. You're like, oh, well, like, I don't think I feel that great, but I definitely don't feel like horrendous. And then all of a sudden the light shines and you're like, actually, I felt horrible and had no idea how bad I felt until I felt better.
Yeah. And I think back to where I was at pre-divorce and then in those beginning few months, I probably thought like, I'm fine. I'm okay. And now when I look back at the me that was going through that, like, oh, girl, you were far from okay, but you were so used to being far from okay for so long that becomes your norm.
Yeah. It's like fight or flight, right? So you're just like doggy paddling because you're in this horrible situation, but you don't even, I mean, you know it's bad, but you have no idea how bad it is till you come out on the other end.
Right. Well, let's get into this topic for today then, because I feel like this is like big stuff. And this is the stuff that we hear about all the time. And it's a little bit of piggybacking on last week's episode, which is where we talked about the biggest mistakes that we see people make again and again and again. And this episode, we're talking about the questions that we get. Some of the most common questions, and then some of them are more specific questions that have been tossed out in our How Not to Suck at Divorce community, which is our private group over on Facebook. But these are some things that if other people are going through it, you're probably going through it. And some of these questions I have sort of more summarized and generalized because it's really kind of what we hear all the time. So we're going to go through this and you are going to get the top questions that we hear from our show regarding divorce. Shall we begin?
Let's do this.
Okay, let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start. How do you tell your spouse that you want a divorce?
Okay, let's hop in. I mean, I think there's do's and don'ts about how you tell your spouse. And I do think that it's very fact specific to your case, but I'm going to give you a few do's and don'ts. A do, always tell them in a public yet private place if possible.
What I mean
by that is it's not always the best idea to tell them in your house because things can go very haywire where people are very comfortable and able to say and do whatever they want when they're angry. Mm-hmm. So I would prefer, you know, a quiet Starbucks, a restaurant, something where everyone, especially if you're worried about your spouse getting a little out of control or angry, a public place is always the best place to do it. Even on a walk in the park where other people are around, maybe not next to you, but, you know, close by, just in case, just to make sure everybody is okay and safe and acts appropriate. That's one do.
Do you remember the movie Crazy Sexy Love with Steve Carell and Ryan Gosling's in it and Julianne Moore? You remember this?
No, remind me like what the premise was of it.
Well, like Steve Carell is separated. The very beginning of the movie, he gets separated from Julianne Moore. And then while he's living on his own, he meets Ryan Gosling out at like the Sad Man's Bar. And then Ryan Gosling helps him get his mojo back. Ooh. But then on the side, Ryan Gosling starts dating. Who is it? Emma Stone? Is that her name? The cute redhead girl? I don't know. Who's Steve Carell's daughter in the movie. Did you not see this movie? No?
I don't even know.
Okay. Well, okay. Here's my point. In the beginning of the movie, Julianne Moore and Steve Carell are out for dinner. And they're like, okay, what should we get for dessert? I'm thinking about it. Okay, on the count of three, let's say which item we want. Ready? One, two, three. And he says like tiramisu. And she says, I want a divorce.
Oh, yeah. So yes, I think that in that case, that would be a do. Do it. Maybe not over, you know, tiramisu, but somewhere where it's not going to get, I always worry about safety and behavior and reactions, and it's highly unlikely you're going to get a very negative reaction and poor reaction when you're out in public. It's highly likely in a private setting that you might get that. The other thing that I recommend when you're telling somebody about that, number one, you'd already have a lawyer. You already have a plan. So you don't just go tell them before you have these things set up and before you're educated on what it might look like in the future.
Okay, let's back up and let's go over that part again, because I will tell you from being the moderator of our group, that comes up a lot and it almost feels like an uphill battle when you are explaining to people why. It feels very counterintuitive. They think, well, I cannot hire an attorney before I talk to my spouse. So why don't we go a little bit deeper there?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I hear that. And I'm not saying go hire an attorney. I'm saying get your facts together, have a strategy with an attorney that you feel comfortable with before you go and tell your spouse definitively, I want a divorce. The reality is, before you actually tell them definitively, there may have already been talk about it or where your relationship is headed. It's very rare that someone just out of the blue blurts, I want a divorce. There's a lot of stuff that leads up to it. What I mean by talking to a lawyer, I'm not saying go hire a lawyer. A lot of people do that. That's okay as well before you actually talk about it. What I'm saying is know your rights, know what the path of divorce looks like, and also talk to a person about how to tell your spouse. And what I mean by that is, depending on some facts of the case, what I may say to them is, I want to have filed for divorce because I feel uncomfortable with what your spouse may do before we give him that, him or her, that notice. And I might also even get as granular as telling somebody, this is the day that I think we should file for divorce, and or this is the day I think you should tell them. And the reason I actually pick a day, a lot of times I don't like it when spouses tell each other they want a divorce on a weekend. And the reason I don't like weekends to be the time that they tell them is, number one, gives people a lot of time off of work to really get stuck in that discussion. The other thing is, for lawyers, for safety purposes, it's really hard for us to get help or help you when the court system is closed. So I always think that a weekday is the best day to talk about something like that.
Very, very good guidance here. Okay. Let's move into the next question. This question came from the private community. I'm going to kind of summarize what we've got here, but basically it says, okay, after reviewing my spouse's financial affidavit, it's clear that my spouse is not being truthful as far as what my spouse makes, what my spouse has. We have tried to obtain, my attorney has filed rather numerous subpoenas. Obtaining documents has been a really long, hard process. After reviewing some of the documents, it's clear to my attorney that my spouse dissipated marital assets. We don't really know what we're going to find out. We have to get more information, yada, 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 yada. What do I do from here?
Okay. Yeah, I hate those situations. It's so tricky because you're really kind of tasked with the decision of, is it worth continuing to dig? And how far do you go? Is the juice worth the squeeze, right? So I think there's a bunch of issues there. Number one, I'm hearing an issue of kind of non-compliance with discovery. And if you are somebody that's seen a little bit of things that have come back that cause mistrust, or you're seeing things that have been outward lies, that may lead you to dig more. And if they're not turning it over willingly, then I certainly suggest subpoenaing any institution or person to get to that information. But at some point, if you've done your due diligence, you have to talk to your lawyer about, is it worth it to continue to go down this path? What kind of reward am I going to get at the end of the day if we keep going down this path trying to discover assets? A lot of times, the good news is, if you negotiate a settlement with somebody who's not always the most forthright person, in those cases, I always recommend a clause that basically says, look, if you didn't disclose something and we find it post-divorce and you had it during the divorce or beforehand, you owe us at minimum 50 or 60% plus attorney's fees. And if somebody truly isn't hiding something, they will be more than willing to put that into a divorce settlement document. If they are hiding something, they're going to be a little more hesitant to agree to something like that. So I hear discovery issues. And the other thing you can do is go to court and show the court how they're not being compliant with discovery. And there are sanctions that a court or a judge could levy upon them. So I'm hearing that issue. The second issue I'm hearing is something called dissipation. And it's probably called something different in other states. It's basically where you're taking marital monies and spending them for a non-marital purpose, and you're looking to get some of those monies back into the marital estate. The quintessential time that we see this is when somebody is spending marital money on a girlfriend or a boyfriend. I mean, very simple. That's, you know, straight up dissipation. There's a lot of other times that we see dissipation or what could be dissipation. The issue with dissipation, at least where I am, is it costs so much to get it back. And it requires trial and going to the judge, et cetera. I'm not saying that it's not worth it, but there's also other ways to use it to your advantage. And what I mean by that is you want to talk to your lawyer about whether it's worth it, meaning dollar-wise, is it worth putting together a dissipation claim? I mean, if we're looking at like, at least in my cases, a few thousand dollars of dissipation, I'm going to tell my client this is not worth your time or energy. Right. If we're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in dissipation, which sometimes I have to deal with in my cases, that would certainly probably be worth it. So it all depends on...
I'd love to be that girlfriend.
Exactly. So those are things that you need to... That's the first premise. Does it make sense to continue down this path? The other thing is if it doesn't make sense maybe to see it all the way through, does it make sense to put it forth for purposes of leverage and negotiation? Because a lot of people who are, for lack of a better term, the dissipators, the person who's spending the money for a non-marital purpose, they don't like being called out for that. And although a lot of it may be easy to disprove and you need to know the law with your lawyer about how to do it, it still puts this negative kind of air out in the case. And it's something that has to be dealt with. And sometimes people negotiate better outcomes when that's out there as a negotiation tool. So overall, I think that the person probably had a two-pronged question there. And you know, I think this is a really good time to have a sit down with your lawyer and ask where this case could go and what options you have, because it seems like there's some frustration there.
I just wonder, like, where did I go wrong in life? I've never been someone's like sugar baby.
Me either. I feel like I've worked, I think I was working at like age 7.
I know.
I'm still like, working.
I mean, and I'm not minimizing affairs by any stretch. Like, it's without saying that those are painful and such a fucking nightmare. But on the other hand, god damn. What do you feel like you would spend it on? Like, if somebody was like, I'll pay for you, what do you need? Like, where do you feel like your millions would go?
Ooh. Well, you know, I love travel, so I would totally travel. And, you know, I love face products and facials and all those kind of things. I would do all that stuff. I mean, truly. What
can
about you?
Imagine me in an affair. I'm like, okay, I don't really like to go anywhere. And I don't really like groups. And, ooh, you want me to go out late at night? Ugh, that's not going to work for me. And you want me to have sex with you? Oh, yeah. I don't really like do that. Can we just like maybe hang out and like talk about our anxiety?
Oh my God. I mean, I think I said it last episode, but Andrea, you are the total package girlfriend. You are the dream girl.
I mean, not for nothing, but like how I love it that of all people, I'm the one who moved on and like am already like engaged post-divorce. I don't know how. Like, how did lightning hit me? Because I am nothing without my evening magnesium water and like antidepressants. But you know, here I am, living my best life.
Maybe that's why you're not the taken care of woman.
Maybe, but I kid. I mean, I'm not that bad, people. You don't need to like worry about me. I'm totally fine. But yeah, it's just so funny because I'm thinking like, what would I spend it on? I don't even know. I mean, like, obviously, like the same shit everyone else probably does, like designer handbags and more plastic surgeries and, you know, shit for my kids. But other than that, I'd be like, I don't really want to go anywhere. Okay, moving on, shall we, to more important pressing matters. Next question. Here we go. Has anyone done a trial separation, like an official trial separation? Am I doing the right thing or am I just putting off the inevitable? My husband and I are best friends. We get along really well, But he has a sex addiction that he's been hiding from me, hence the possibility of a divorce. So I'm just curious if anybody found the value in doing an official separation before filing.
This one's a tough one. This is tough. And this is, I think, more in a therapy realm that we would want to look into this. But what I always say is, if you're going to make it work, you're going to make it work together. If you separate, there's always one person who might have a problem, like this gentleman seems to have some kind of an issue, or there's someone in the relationship that might have a foot out the door, or somebody who kind of in the relationship is enjoying some of the things about the relationship, but not everything. And what I see happening in a trial separation where people just kind of get two separate residences and still, you know, talk like they do normally every day, but they literally go home and go to bed in separate residences. At some point, you kind of have to ask yourself whether you're letting your spouse have their cake and eat it too. And what I mean by that is, if your spouse is the one that has the issue and now they're going to move out, but they get full access to you for all of the support mentally and emotionally that you always gave before, but now they have their own residence to just do whatever they want, it's kind of like having their cake and eating it too. Or if the spouse, you know, relies upon the other spouse for, you know, dinner at night or taking care of the kids, and their problem is they're a drinker and you want them out. Well, now that's lovely. They get to come and see the kids when they want, and they eat dinner as a family, and then they go to another house and, you know, drink and enjoy it like they're single. So you just kind of have to be careful about, number one, you have to identify, do you truly want to make this marriage work? And number two, you have to think about, be careful with what you wish for, because that may almost tip the scales into a divorce. Sometimes it makes it easier for the other spouse to just kind of enjoy. So why did we start this show? Well, to help save you money in your divorce. Actually, more than that, I want to help save you money and avoid major mistakes in your divorce. How does that sound?
And that is exactly why we created the Divorce Crash Course. And guys, this divorce course is different than any other divorce course out there because it's easy to understand, it's fast, it's entertaining, and it's effective. So along with 5 short videos, we give you a printable guidebook that's going to keep you on track and organized throughout your entire divorce process. And I know that Morgan's not going to brag about herself, so I'll go ahead and do it. You guys are going to be getting guidance from one of our country's top family law attorneys at a fraction of her hourly rate. And I'll be honest with you, we did not launch this course for the money, because if we were doing this thing for the money, we'd be charging a whole lot more than $97.
Exactly. And so for only $97, which, yes, is a fraction of the cost of most family law attorneys' hourly rates, you'll have all the tools you'll need to be the most efficient in your divorce process. And friends, this course will help you at any stage in your divorce process. And if you're worried about how this may show up on your credit card, we've got this. The credit card charge will show up as DCC 150.
But more than save you money, you guys, I don't want you to make the mistakes that I made when I got divorced. And I don't want you to suffer or your kids to suffer unnecessarily. So go check out the Divorce Crash Course. www.thedivorcecrashcourse.com. Direct link in our show notes.
I wonder, you know, I'm thinking about people who are in this position who are sort of vacillating between, like, what's the point of the separation? Do we do this? Do we separate? Do we not separate? Am I just putting off the inevitable? And I wonder, so I think that for a lot of people who do a separation, I don't know that they have complete access to the other person. Like, what about the people who really are, for most intents and purposes, are acting as though they are divorced? Mm-hmm. Like, they're really separating. And again, I don't know what that means, like, for the kids, because I'm not so well-versed on these, like, trial separations, because I didn't go through that. But I just wonder, does it serve a purpose? Like, does it give anybody a taste? In your experience, Morgan, like, have you had clients who do this. And then that time period showed them like, yeah, I'm a lot happier without her.
Yeah. So usually what I see happening when people do that is it shows both sides that they can live alone. So if they're truly trying to work on their marriage and really want to make it work, usually in my background, it's not separating that will help them achieve that. It's really working through the issues when they're in each other's space, when they have to accommodate one another. It's not running to their separate houses that will help. It really kind of only solidifies like, yeah, I can make this work like on my own. I'm okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, now we know. Wanted to get your opinion. Okay. Moving on to the actual divorce process, jumping in to one of the more serious issues, because, you know, why not? We're going to talk a lot, actually, about GALs. So before we get into the GAL-specific questions, why don't we do a little bit of, like, information, background information for people on what a GAL is, at least, like, where we're located and what the role that a GAL serves?
Yes. So in Illinois, we have two types of, for lack of a better term, attorneys that can be placed on a case to help determine the best interest for the children. The first is a GAL, which is called a guardian ad litem. That is really the eyes and ears of the court. That person is the court's expert and really the court's witness. And the person that's trying to figure out by talking to the parties, maybe meeting with the children, hearing the issues, how to resolve the issues in the best interests of the children and make sure that their interests are number one. The tricky part with GALs is that anything the parties say to them or put in writing is open for evidence, meaning that comes right into the court. It's not confidential, et cetera. So you have to be careful with how you're using them and when your client is talking to them. I know for me, a lot of what I tell my clients when there's a GAL on, you will not speak to the GAL. You will not send them an email without us approving it first. And that's really to make sure that the client doesn't mess up their own case because they don't know what's helpful. What they think might be helpful may be very detrimental to their case. And the minute I see them send a rogue email without us approving it, I get in front of it right away and say, don't do that again, to keep them out of their own way. The other person that can be placed on a case is called, at least in Illinois, is called a child's representative or a child's rep. And that person has, it's basically like a divorce attorney for the child. So they have full confidentiality with the child. They have to file motions just like a lawyer would. And they're placed on when they think that a child really needs a confidential relationship and someone advocating for them and their positions.
No, fuck. Okay. So we hear more about GALs than we do a child's rep. And this is actually one of the questions, so let's start here. How do you know if a GAL, and I'll just add, or a child's rep, is going to help your case or hurt your case? When do you advocate that you want one? Does somebody even say, I want one? Or is it something that you wait for a judge to slap on to your case? And is it a bad thing?
Wow, there's like 20 questions.
I'm sorry. I know.
I mean, I'm amped because of my antibiotics, but that was a lot. No, but we're going to get through this. All right, so few things. Number one, a judge can appoint a GAL in a case at any point in time, generally. It's discretionary, so it's up to them. If they hear something they don't like, they think that a GAL would be helpful, they could put one on at any point in time. I always try to settle the case without a GAL, if we can. And the reason is because a GAL is another person that you have to pay. It's another opinion in the matter. They potentially may talk to your children. Now, don't let it scare you. They are professionals. They know how to talk to children about this, et cetera. And honestly, if you have a GAL appointed on your case, you're probably in a pretty tough spot with your case and your kids at that point. So if I can't get it settled without a GAL, that's when we start talking to the client about a GAL and the pros and the cons and what they may accomplish. So a lot of times, you know, especially in cases where there might be substance abuse or abuse or verbal abuse or really difficult, bad judgment parenting, you know, what the one side who's usually the problem, the, you know, the one with the substance abuse problem, the abuser, the person who has bad judgment parenting, they're never going to admit those things. And they're usually taking very unreasonable positions with regards to the children. Maybe they're demanding 50-50 parenting time and they're just not stable, et cetera. That's, if we can't settle it, then that's when probably it makes sense to put somebody else on board to really kind of do the investigation and come back. It's a neutral party to say, hey, you know, there's some issues here that I'm concerned about. And that's when usually they're helpful. But for the most part, I try to wait a little bit to put them on.
We have a question that came through in our group about, oh, wait, before I get into that, talk a little bit about the difference between a GAL and a child's rep. How would you know when one needs one and not the other?
Well, so for instance, oh, this is a hard one to delineate, but really the child's rep is, at least where I practice, is not put on a lot. But where I would advocate for a child's rep is somebody maybe with a child that's maybe more middle-aged, a kid that's probably like 12, 13, 14, 15, like somewhere around those. Mm-hmm. Yeah, an adolescent, around those ages that's maybe struggling in certain areas. Also, maybe if they have some mental health issues, those kind of things. That's when and a super high conflict case. That's where it might make sense to put a child's rep on, because it's truly a confidential attorney that's going to advocate for that child. And you should know, this is one thing that is tricky, but has happened. Sometimes judges will put on a child's rep and a GAL.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very rare, but I've seen it happen, and I've seen it happen for good reason. And so, you know, that's something that could happen. But really, the trigger point is the confidentiality, and that would be a child's rep. And the GAL basically is not confidential. So anything they find out, anything that they're told, et cetera, is not confidential.
Okay. Now, I want to get into this just a tiny bit more, and then we're going to move on to the specific questions. But who does a GAL speak to? And who does a GAL not speak to? Because I know that there are always a lot of questions about, is a GAL the same thing as a custody evaluator? Are they going to come in my home and see what my home looks like? Are they speaking to my kid's school? Are they speaking to their therapists? Are they testifying in court? Or what does that actually look like?
Yeah. Okay. So a good GAL, first of all, it all depends on what the real issue is. There's always a core issue. So whether it's you can't get to a parenting agreement because someone's a drinker, or you can't get to a parenting agreement because somebody has been physically abusive to you and the children, those are issues that the GAL is going to really identify what the main issues are and start investigating. So it truly depends on what the main issues are to see how in-depth a GAL is going to get. If the issues are far and wide, let's just say it's World War III, total implosion, very difficult parent co-parenting relationship, the kids are struggling, et cetera, a good GAL should do a lot. They're going to definitely interview both sides of the parents. I've seen them come to homes if they need to. That's rare, but I've seen it. Mm-hmm. I've seen them interview children, sometimes in the homes, or sometimes you bring the children to their office. They talk to therapists, and it depends on the children, because there is a certain age where the children have to approve it. But if they're under that age, they will talk to the children's therapist. Sometimes they even talk to the parents' therapist. The parents would have to obviously sign releases for them to talk to it. But if you have nothing to hide and you're trying to prove your case, most parents will sign those releases. Mm-hmm. I've even had them call schools, talk to teachers, medical providers. If there's been like incidents that have happened, they will call people who've been present. They'll call neighbors, they'll call nannies, call everyone. Why do they do that? Because at the end of the day, if they are tasked with trying to figure out what's in the best interest of the children, and they are the court's witness, and they need to stand up before that judge and say, this is my recommendation and here's what it's based on. And then one side says, no, I don't I'm not going to agree to that. There's going to be a trial and they will be a witness. Mm-hmm. They will take the witness stand and they have to hold up their recommendation with all the things that they've done. So if you have a GAL that's basically done nothing and says, this is what I recommend, the other side's lawyer is going to rip them to shreds about what they didn't do. So that is certainly something that's out there. And most good divorce attorneys know the good GALs that are thorough, that are caring, that will go, you know, and do what they need to do. So you want to be careful with who's appointed.
Oi, oi, oi. One last question about a GAL. Both parties pay for that cost, correct? It's usually split between the two.
Well, it comes out of the marital estate and it's just like a, you know, fee for your lawyer. And if there is no marital estate, then the judge will allocate who pays what. Usually, at least where I am, there's always a division of who's paying what, meaning there's not one parent that's just not paying anything. The judge is going to usually want both parents to have skin in the game because mm-hmm. if you're going to use this person to try to figure something out, you're both going to be paying something.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Moving on, shall we? Talking about, let's stick on the parent topic for a minute here. Let's talk about parental alienation. Dun, dun, dun. Mm-hmm. The question is, anyone ever dealt with accusations of parental alienation during a custody battle? What does parental alienation actually mean? Could the kid being upset with mom, this was a dad who asked this question, could the kids being upset with mom be used as an argument that I am alien from her? Meaning the kids have their own reasons to be upset with mom, but can mom turn this around and make it look like dad is putting this in their head?
Yes. I pause because I think this is like, you know how you and I always talk about the fact that we despise the term narcissist because it's overused.
And this isn't right.
This is another like wordplay that happens all the time that's thrown out. It's like the total move. It's like the lever that people pull
parental
the minute
they're alienation.
Yes.
Alienation.
Fun, fun. But I don't want to minimize it either because no. I have seen horrendous parental alienation cases. But kind of what this guy's talking about is she, you know, probably wife is going to say, you're alienating the kids from me because the kids are mad at me. But usually alienation is pretty serious and pretty steady. And the courts don't take it lightly. It's not like the kids are mad at you because, you know, you were untimely picking them up or you're getting divorced and they're just mad in general. It's really a very big pattern of behavior that continues down the road and almost has alienated the children to a point where like the relationship is completely broken down. So that is severe alienation. And that's when the courts kind of take notice of it. If you know, one thing I want to give our users and our listeners, if you think that those kind of things are happening and you might have to go down the road of a custody evaluation, et cetera, you might want to think about hiring a consultant. There are former evaluators who are retired now that will consult on cases to help prep you before you go into an evaluation like that. And they may meet with you and say to you, you know what, you don't, these allegations don't rise to the level of alienation. So I don't want you to go into a custody evaluation or even talk to the GAL and say alienation over and over because you're going to look crazy. And that's what we don't want to have happen. We have to be really careful about the story we weave and make sure we can back it up and that it's not turned around on you.
So I think one of the morals of that explanation, and this reminds me a little bit of the conversation we had when we had James Quigley on our show, which is don't buy into everything that's being thrown your way. We hear these terms a lot and people are going to throw things at you. You're going to think, oh my God, I'm being threatened with parental alienation. This is going to be major. You should know if you're guilty of something. If you're not, if you haven't been slowly and steadily planting these seeds within your kids to separate them from the other parent, then you probably don't have anything to worry about, right?
Yeah, agreed. I call it a lever. It's just a lever that, like, it's almost like a tantrum that people throw. And it's a red herring. It's a red herring in probably 85% of the cases. Mm-hmm. I would say that 15% of the cases are truly something that you have to kind of perk up and say, yeah, this could rise to alienation. The majority, it's somebody lobbing an allegation at you.
Okay, so sticking with the theme of people being little pains in the tushies, here's another question. My ex is recording our conversations. Is he allowed to do this? And what does it serve?
Okay. So depending on what state you're in, I want you to Google eavesdropping statute and also recording statute, et cetera, or recording law or eavesdropping law in your state. Every state is different. Illinois, it is not appropriate and legal to record somebody on the phone without them knowing that you're recording them. In Illinois, you can record them on video if you are in a public place, but you can't do it in your house unless they consent basically to it. So you have to be careful about the laws. At the end of the day, though, who would prosecute somebody? You know, that's the tricky part. I don't know, but I would never, ever counsel a client to violate the law. So what I suggest for this listener is, if they're recording on the phone, then stop talking to them on the phone if you know they're recording on the phone, and tell them over and over again, I do not consent to being recorded. If they're recording you in a public place, maybe at like pickup or drop off, there's not much you can do, just behave. If they're recording you in your home and you see them recording you in your home, you are immediately going to say, I do not consent to this recording, and say it throughout while the recording is going on, and try not to engage with them. What they may be trying to do is use it for a custody case or to show the judge or something like that. So you just need to know that you're being baited. Don't buy into it. Cut it off and talk to your lawyer. There's so many times that we put court orders in place that prohibit either side from recording each other. It just happens a lot. It's a tool that people think they can use. And then the minute that attorneys hear about it or the judge, it's cut off.
Okay. So the second part of that question is, what purpose does it serve? Can it ever be used? Typically, no.
Well, it could be used a lot of times if you're out in public and you're doing something insane, like for instance, I love ring doorbells. Doorbells are like evidence from God. They catch so much stuff and so much stuff clearly. Mm-hmm. So know how you're behaving outside, because that's fair game. I mean, if you roll up for parenting time and you drop your kids off and you act like a complete lunatic, I would love that video. And you know how it's going to be used? In every way possible to show you're a lunatic. Mm-hmm. You are. The judge is going to see it. The GAL is going to see it. Opposing counsel is going to see it. I mean, you are just handing your case on a platter to them. Mm. Now, if it's inside your house and you're not consenting to it, again, behave. Behave. If you can't behave, leave. Walk out the door and have your lawyer handle it, because they're trying to use it against you. Any video they're trying to use against you in the court case, bottom line.
Moving on. Next question. How late is too late to switch attorneys? We just had our second mediation session that was not successful, and now we have to get a GAL involved. I have not always felt as though my attorney has pushed back against my abusive ex requests and ridiculous demands, and I'm not sure if it's too late to hire a different attorney, whom I wish I would have hired from the beginning. What do I
do? Okay. I don't think that there's really ever, except maybe you are literally on the eve of trial, I don't think there's ever a bad time to hire a new attorney. I don't love people who hire 9 attorneys for one case. I don't think that's a good look for anyone. But if you've lost confidence in your attorney and you just need a fresh start, I think it's totally acceptable. I would ask the listener to back up a little bit and think through a few things. So for instance, I've been to many mediation sessions that have failed. And when you come out of a failed mediation session, you need to know a few things. Number one is your attorney shouldn't be acting like a complete animal in the mediation session and going to town on your ex. That's mm-hmm. not the purpose of mediation. In fact, if your attorney did that and went in guns blazing and, you know, was screaming and yelling and taking unreasonable positions, the mediation would have ended long before it probably did. So it would get you nowhere. It'd be a giant waste of your money. The second thing you have to know too is, and you have to kind of look inward at yourself, and you have to ask yourself whether your position is unreasonable. Because if a mediation fails, usually it takes two to tango, unless there is one person that's completely unreasonable, which might have been the case. But then if that's the case, there has to be a different strategy, and you have to know that mediation might not be the best mode for you in your case. So I just caution people because I've been through a bunch of failed mediations. Most of the time they're successful, but there are failures. And a lot of times when I have a failed mediation, there are many factors. One, the client tie my hands, meaning I've had clients tell me that I can't use certain facts. I can't say certain things. I can't take the position I want to take. And I tell them all the reasons why that's not a good idea, but they make me do it because it's their case. And then it all falls apart. And that's something that you have to look at yourself on. The second reason could be the other side could be completely unreasonable. Another reason could be that my client's expectations are on. They're not listening to what I'm saying as to what the outcome should be or could be. You know, if you come in and it's a perfectly kind of normal parenting between you and your ex, but you are just convinced that they should have basically no time with the children, you know, that might not be a reasonable position to ultimately, and you're not going to get it done in mediation. So I think that if the listener has heard everything I just said, and none of that applies to them, and it's truly an attorney problem, or you've totally lost faith, absolutely, go for it. Go find somebody that you feel comfortable with, because it's all about your comfort as well.
I have a thought, and I want to know what you think about this, Morgan, honestly, because listening to what you said and having thinking about how this question was served up, I know a few things. I know that number one, where we live, mediation is the protocol, right? Like you've got to mediate. You know, and we know that mediation is not always successful. Now, she said they've been through two, so that, you know, one of them was obviously by choice and not something they had to do. I'm thinking, though, and I'm thinking back to the episode we did about switching attorneys. Would this be a situation where it would behoove this person to go and have a consultation with another attorney and say, hey, would you do anything differently in this situation? Because it might be that maybe this person just needs to hear, no, there's really nothing else that can be done. Or if they hear, yeah, you know, I would do this, this, and this, and it's a completely different strategy than what your attorney mapped out, and this new strategy feels really appealing to you and you feel secure, then that means maybe it is time to switch.
Yes, I would say even go a little bit step further. I mean, if the person has two failed mediations and has kind of lost confidence in their lawyer, I would almost interview two other lawyers and see, and get both of their opinions. Because the reason I say it is that the reality is, especially, sound bad, but like in the smaller firms where they need the business, right? They need mm-hmm. new cases in the door. They may sometimes sell you what you want to hear. And so that's why I say interview two, because a good lawyer, like we always say, if you're wrong, is going to tell you you're wrong. Unreasonable because it can't be achieved in court or in settlement. That should be told to you.
Right.
And so that's why I say I would interview two if I was this person.
You know, and like relating it to like medical stuff, if you were dealing with a major illness, you'd probably go and get a second opinion, right? Like before you make a major decision. So keep that in mind. Just like how we tell you when you are initially hunting for an attorney, do not hire the first person you speak to. You know, that stuff. Okay, we're going to wrap this thing up with one more question. And here it is. Does anyone have experience requesting an order with a judge? Again, we've tried mediation, failed, and now we're engaging in the most expensive pen pal relationship with our lawyers, writing letters back and forth. I am done, and I just want to sit down with the judge. I don't want to do a full-blown divorce court. We're only arguing about support. All property has already been divided. What should I do?
You should stop the letter writing campaign. Tell your lawyer, no more. We're done. That drives me crazy. It's like the old school way of practicing. It's like these long drawn out letters that cost $1 million. And I swear they're always sent out on like Friday at 4 p.m. just to amp up that one side. You know, it's like, hey, have a great weekend, you MFer. Here you go. Here's your letter. But what I'm saying is I'm past that. That used to be like, that's like so 10 years ago. So you want to tell your lawyer, like, we're done. We're done engaging in these letters. If there's anything to be communicated, it's a short email or it is on the phone, at least at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's probably at the time where I always suggest getting a motion on file for support. And then if they want, they could always do a pretrial with the judge. So that's where they lay out the facts. They say, judge, can you give us your recommendation? The judge gives a recommendation. They try to settle upon that recommendation. And then ultimately, if they still can't settle, they would go and do what's called a hearing or a mini, you know, kind of trial on that issue. So at some point, if you feel like you're spinning your wheels, it's time to go in a new direction. And at least I always find that you get leverage when you file some things in court.
And friends, one of the phrases that Morgan just said, I feel like you probably feel this all the time. You're spinning your wheels. And that is so frustrating and so exhausting. And we get it. And I hope that listening to our show, listening to this episode, and listening to all of our other episodes helps you feel like you're not just spinning your wheels, because that's not going to get you anywhere, right? It doesn't get you stuck out of a snowbank. It doesn't get you stuck out of the mud. And that's what we're trying to do. We want to get you moving forward in this. And the only way that you're going to move forward is by taking action. So make sure that with everything you're doing in your divorce, that you are moving forward. If you feel like you're stuck, reach out to us, send us a DM on Instagram, send us a message, post on the How Not to Suck a Divorce community page. We're here for you. We want to answer your questions.
And if you love our podcast, please leave us a review. We love all of the reviews that we receive and we appreciate every one of them. Remember, friends, divorce is a marathon. It is not a sprint. Not every day is going to be a good day. In fact, some days are going to be really crappy days, and that's okay, because there's light at the end of the tunnel. We promise you that.
Your divorce will not last forever. I know that it feels like it will. And if you're in the middle of this place, and even the things that we're talking about on this episode, I mean, my God, seriously, lions, tigers, and bears, oh my, and GALs to boot. Like, what the fuck? We get it. This will not be your forever. This is just where you're at right now. And we do this show to help you doggy paddle your way through this process. And I promise you, it's going to end and you're going to be a much happier and much healthier person.
Yep, I couldn't have said it better. And take it from Andrea. She knows. She's been there and been there recently. And listen, we only hit like a few of our questions that we get. We'll try to do more and keep you up to date with to us. We always answer every DM. And in the meantime, remember this, you have got this.
And we have got you.